Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 9th day of May, 2020. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's update the progress now on the American version of the Bolshevik Revolution. The greatest and actually most successful attack on this nation by far in our history. And if you doubt that, stay tuned. And we'll start with a story that came out over last weekend, courtesy of Mike Adams and Natural News, suggesting that the evil Dr. Strangelove, a.k.a. Fauci, may really be President Trump's Rasputin after all. Red Alert, it says, President Trump pivots to mandatory vaccination and has now jumped in with Big Pharma's diabolical warp speed mass medical experiment on the American people. Over the past 2 months, begins Adams, we watched in horror as Big Pharma and its death science puppets like Dr. Fauci, and let's not forget the infamous Bill Gates himself, appear to have taken over the White House and the Trump administration's response to the coronavirus 1984 plandemic. Now we've got yet more confirmation that Big Pharma has completed its coup against the United States in the form of capturing the president, who seems now to be promoting a pivot to mandatory vaccines as part of that disgustingly named Warp Speed project being pushed by Big Pharma and their Dr. Mengele in the White House. And all of this comes on the heels of the old news at this point that Dr. Fauci is tied to funneling money to the communist Chinese Wuhan BSL-4 Virology and Bioweapons Lab that developed the coronavirus, perhaps with his help, as a biological weapon. Even Newsweek is now admitting that Dr. Fauci was right in the middle of the cash injections to the communist death science industry, and this, says Adams, is the man who now appears to be directing Trump's response to the COVID-1984 pandemic in America. But Max Slavo at SHTF Plan has documented Trump's pivot to a Manhattan Project-style warp speed attempt to turn every American into a guinea pig for a massive, dangerous medical experiment involving unsafe, barely tested coronavirus vaccines, with the goal of making enough doses for most Americans, i.e. 350 million or so of these abominations by year's end. Means the president seems to now be siding with Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci against little concepts like the, well, right to choose. And how about, folks, my body, my choice? Isn't it funny that the very same tyrants who echo that when it comes to killing babies in the womb couldn't give a flying you-know-what when it comes to you and whether it's your body and your choice to get poked or not with you-don't-know-what? And here's the irony, folks. They intend to poke you anyway, unless you learn to say hell no real fast and back that up somehow. And guess who has total and complete indemnity against any harm that might result? Yeah, the same people that stand to make billions by poking you. Do you think there just might be a motivation to cut a few corners and say, the heck with the problems that it could cause? Nobody's going to be allowed to sue us, but we get paid for it anyway, whether it works or not. But it gets worse. Operation Warp Speed is a project that will join major pharmaceutical companies with government agencies and, of course, the military. I guess that does make sense if you want to put down the inevitable violent response to this kind of violent attack on the American people. So it looks like what's being unveiled here is a public-private partnership that's arguably straight out of hell, if not the Book of Revelation. It's time to call a spade, writes Adams, and a tyrant a tyrant. What the heck has happened to Trump that he would so quickly pivot to join up with the biggest and most corrupt pharmaceutical companies in the world? Gee, where's IG Farben when you need him? Oh, hey, wait, we know the answer. They're still running some of this. Mike Adams asked the question that more and more of us are having to face up to at this point. Has Trump really been this truly completely co-opted by the deep state swamp? Or has he just been a wolf in sheep's clothing all along? We did have our first big clues after the Las Vegas false flag and cover-up when he signed up for the asinine bump stock ban, saying the hell with the Second Amendment, declaring pieces of plastic to be fully automatic machine guns, which, of course, the Second Amendment said should not be infringed anyway, back when we had it. He followed that up with support for red flag laws, putting a wooden stake not only in the Second Amendment, but the concept of private property to boot. And now we have universal basic income via the back door, insane levels of national debt that were already out of control but now are completely beyond reason, the Federal Reserve buying up all the assets in the country, rapidly worsening censorship and big tech tyranny, no labeling of poisons like genetically modified frankenfoods, no investigations into the vaccine industry, certainly no lock 'em up, unless they're genuine whistleblowers or people who thought they were on Team Trump, and literally nothing that would defend human freedom or liberty. Since this regime now seems to be firing photon torpedoes at the American people and talking about other Star Trek things like Operation Warp Speed, maybe we ought to note the famous Vulcan proverb that only Nixon could go to China. Well, I guess the modern update is only President Trump could usher in Bolshevik Revolution 2.0 to formerly free America. Next item, some salient comments from Dennis Prager, entitled, Our Dress Rehearsal for a Police State. And he begins by noting that all my life I've dismissed various paranoids, both on the right, America is headed to communism, and on the left, it can happen here, referring to fascism, when in fact what we've got now are both, folks. It's not, he says, that I've ever believed liberty was guaranteed. Being familiar with history and a pessimist regarding the human condition, I never believed that. But the ease with which police state tactics have now been employed, and the equal ease with which most Americans have actually accepted them, without too much thought, have been breathtaking. People might argue that a temporary police state has been justified because of the allegedly unique threat posed by the new COVID-1984 coronavirus. I don't believe, he says, data will bear that out. But regardless, let's at least agree that we're closer now to a police state than ever before in American history. And note here, he says, police state doesn't at least immediately mean totalitarian state. Some of us might think it's a bit closer to that than even Prager wants to admit. Anyway, America, he says, is not yet a totalitarian state. We still have some freedoms left. And after all, this article couldn't be published if it was completely over the cliff. But we are presently living with all four of the key hallmarks of a police state. Well, here we go, he says. Number one, draconian laws that deprive citizens of basic civil rights. Well, I would prefer to say God-given, once constitutionally protected rights, as you know. And obviously, now we have federal, state, county, and city governments restricting almost every freedom, including, even if it's still limited, travel and speech. Americans have been banned from going to work, earning a living. All right, well, you know all of that. How about number two? A mass media supportive of the state's messaging, i.e. propaganda, and its plan to deprive them of their God-given, constitutionally protected rights. Yep, the New York Times, other criminally negligent networks, and virtually everything else in the waste stream media has served the cause of state control over American individual lives even more effectively than Pravda served the Soviet government. Number three, the use of police. Clearly, police departments throughout America have now agreed to enforce these laws and edicts with what can only be described as frightening alacrity. After hearing me describe police summonses given to or even arresting of people for playing baseball with their children in a park or on a beach, jogging alone without a mask, worshiping, etc., etc., it's clear that the police will tell you, well, they are only following orders. They must respond to every dispatch they receive, they say. And why are they being dispatched to a person jogging on a beach or sitting alone in a park? Well, answer, because they are lawbreakers, whether the law is a real law or not. How about number four, snitches? How do police dispatchers learn about lawbreakers? Like families playing softball in a public park, people jogging alone without their mandated face mask, and etc. Answer, by fellow citizens snitching on them. The mayor of New York City, Communist de Blasio, set up a snitch line allowing New Yorkers to send authorities photos of their fellow New Yorkers violating any of the so-called laws. Constitution notwithstanding, in Los Angeles, the communist mayor there, Eric Garcetti, has similarly encouraged snitching, unabashedly even using the term. It's said, he notes, that about one in every 100 East German citizens were informers for the Stasi, the East German secret police. And ultimately, concludes Dennis Prager, we're now seeing a dress rehearsal because too many Americans appear to be untroubled by the police state that's being built one goose step at a time around them. If you love liberty, he concludes, you better realize we are now more at jeopardy than at any time since America's founding. This next segment now is one I've been working up to for quite a while. It's time to call BS on so many things, especially those that are nothing but veiled attempts to destroy tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people and everything they've worked for. Let's start with this one, representative of several stories I've seen of late about the war on hydroxychloroquine, which I'll introduce by noting that I'm no big fan of big pharma or pharmacopoeia or all kinds of drugs in general, except perhaps as a last resort. Certainly we're all far better off strengthening our immune systems, making sure we have the right minerals and vitamins in them, things like vitamin D3, K2, the sunshine vitamin, vitamin C, and of course supplements that provide us with vital minerals like zinc. But as Monica Showalter begins for The American Thinker, when President Trump brought up hydroxychloroquine as a promising potential treatment for COVID, now we know it is COVID-1984 correctly, a huge upsurge of negative political publicity followed directly from it. It was strange stuff because up until then, the treatment, which had been safely used to treat malaria, lupus, and arthritis for decades, had been seeing promising results for COVID-19 too. Yet, the condemnations from all sides, at least all of the leftists, sites, which is pretty much all you're going to hear about, poured in for weeks, and it wasn't just the political establishment blasting it, it seemed to be the medical establishment too, which raised the obvious questions of whether or not financial interests, like, hey, no treatment but a vaccine will be acceptable, might be involved. And it all started with the press engaging in their by now expected contrariness against Trump when he called the treatment promising. And the logic was simple, obvious, and not surprising. If Trump liked it, then it had to be Orange Man bad. For example, here's one slanted headline and a report from NPR, which ran on April 10th. Quote, COVID-19 patients given unproven drug in Texas nursing home in disconcerting move. But Laura Ingraham eventually published the real story for Fox News, and it's quite a different picture. It goes like this. A Galveston area doctor, Dr. Robin Armstrong, was in charge of a nursing home and found himself in the middle of the worst healthcare nightmare anyone can imagine, a COVID-19 outbreak on a home full of elderly people, and he was in charge. Odds are big they were going to die. And no Showalter, we already know what the coronavirus did to a nursing home in Washington State, and we've subsequently seen what inserting COVID-19 patients into unwilling nursing homes in New York City did to those populations. In other words, it was a death sentence. That was what this man was looking at. In desperation, the Texas doctor decided to treat his threatened patients with hydroxychloroquine as part of that published protocol in a last-ditch effort to save them, and he called it right. Unlike those other places, his patients got well, and his informed judgment saved the lives of a building full of nursing home patients, and he reported he had no real negative side effects such as heart problems brought on by the treatment. He would have been justified to take such risks because his treatment was in fact triage and the alternative was a death sentence, but there wasn't even that. His patients lived, they regained their fragile health, there were no stacked bodies or chaotic medical scenes in his part of Texas on his watch. And, says Monica Showalter, that's frankly a story of heroism and a brilliant medical man who should be celebrated for the huge number of lives he saved. Instead, all he got were trashy headlines like NPR's, painting him as some kind of evildoer. Bad medicine, unproven treatment, everybody gets scared, and of course, no good deed goes unpunished. And the anti-HCQ hysteria spread much further even than the reflexively anti-Trump press. It went deep into the Trump-hating Socialist Democrat Party, which also condemned Trump's favorable mention of HCQ. A young black Democrat state legislator from Michigan who said the treatment almost certainly helped save her life was vilified by what she thought was her own party for even giving President Trump credit for mentioning it. She said thanks, and they threatened to expel her from their socialist far-left party. And this despite the ugly fact that the black community was getting hit harder by coronavirus than others, and therefore stood to gain the most from cheap and plentiful HCQ-related treatments. But for the left, hating Trump was clearly a bigger priority, so if Trump liked it, it must be bad. And all of this, she says, is basically strange as hell. Who the heck should care if Trump likes a treatment or not? If you're sick, what matters is whether it's going to work and whether it's going to be safe. And after all, how could a drug that's been on the market for decades for the treatment of lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and malaria suddenly be bad stuff, particularly since it's been used so successfully to treat COVID-19 abroad? But the negative waves keep coming. She gives example after example, and then goes on to describe her own recommendations based on the scientific literature. My conclusions, writes Monica Showalter, HCQ-based treatments are effective in treating COVID-19 unless they're started too late. Studies cited in opposition have been misinterpreted, invalid, or worse. HCQ and related drugs like azithromycin are some of the most tested and safest of prescription drugs. Severe COVID-19 frequently causes cardiac effects, she writes, including heart arrhythmia. QTC prolonging drugs might amplify this tendency. Millions of people, she writes, regularly take drugs having strong QTC prolongation effect, and neither the FDA nor CDC bother to warn them. HCQ plus AZ combination probably has a mild QTC prolongation effect, but concerns over its negative effects, however minor, can be addressed by respecting contraindications. There's some more medical ease in here, but basically, despite all the attempts by certain authorities to prevent COVID-19 treatments with HCQ and HCQ plus AZ, both components already FDA approved, doctors can prescribe them anyway for COVID-19. Well, after a lot more look at alternatives, she points out there's no smoking gun at this point, but there are a lot of circumstantials that might just point to a big campaign to stomp out any inexpensive and decentralized rival. And if so, it's another manifestation of the swamp going against the interests of the little guy.
And it would seem anybody who even tries to represent those interests. From there, we move on to a far bigger, more pervasive, and yeah, more visibly obvious, great big piece of BS. And, of course, that makes it more politically incorrect as well. Yes, I'm talking about the modern burqa, the placebo mask that people are being vilified if they don't drink the Kool-Aid through. Let's start with this brief piece from a blogger I've known for quite some time who uses the pen name of Silver in various fora and says he doesn't wear face masks when he's out and about unless he absolutely has to. We'll get to the reasons why in just a second. But he says, when I'm in the grocery store or gas station, I often get glares from sanctimonious people who do wear the masks, and sooner or later some busybody will challenge me face to face. And since I don't want to lose my temper, I've been rehearsing a speech. Here it is. I'm a scientist. I earned 3 degrees as a physical scientist from a prestigious university. I've published more than 30 papers in scientific and technical journals. I began reading medical journals 13 years ago, and I've been invited to sit on boards reviewing medical research grant proposals. I've read several journal articles on the use of fabric face masks. The best study, he says, was published in 2011, involving 16 hospitals that had specialized facilities for treating patients with highly infectious diseases. Over 1,600 healthcare workers who treated patients in these specialized wards were followed for 30 days, and they were divided into 3 groups, fabric masks, surgical masks, and no masks. Now listen to this carefully. The no mask group was free to wear disposable surgical masks whenever necessary, but they did not wear them continuously as the surgical mask group did. The cloth mask users were instructed to wash their masks with soap and water every day. And they monitored these workers for respiratory illness, influenza-like illnesses, and laboratory-confirmed respiratory virus infections. The workers who wore cloth masks were 13 times as likely to become infected as the ones who wore surgical masks. So, cloth masks, 13 times worse than surgical masks. And those cloth mask users were roughly 7 times as likely to get an infection as those who wore no masks. Which, he says, pretty well explains why I, who know better, choose not to wear one. And here, of course, your host has to interject, why would I trust some idiot who puts his hand on a Bible and lies to know better than I do about much of anything, especially when it affects my health? Now, he goes on to note that the authors of those studies concluded that, quote, the results caution against the use of cloth masks because moisture retention and the reuse of cloth masks, as well as poor filtration, may result in increased risk of infection. Cloth masks, they concluded, should not be recommended for healthcare workers, particularly in high-risk situations, and guidelines need to be updated. Yeah, he says, those idiots who prattle, it's all about the data, or we must invoke the great god, science, tend to ignore data and science whenever it goes against their preconceived notions, which is basically the antithesis of real science. And, continues Silver, the same thing's happening with social, and I prefer to call it what it is, socialist distancing. I'm not aware, he says, of any quality research that supports the notion that staying 6 feet away from someone does any good at all. And what little published literature there is suggests just the opposite, that the virus can travel much greater distances. And just to bring that point home, we'll follow up with a piece from Anne Barnhart, who writes in a related follow-up, face masks do literally nothing. And she cites information she got from a couple of RNs confirming her earlier thinking on the matter. The first one writes, "Hello, Anne. One thing I don't think people know about masking is that when we don a mask, if we have any virus, we breathe it back inside over and over again, increasing viral load and weakening our own immunity, so we get sicker, which, of course, seems to be the point. I'm an RN," she said, "graduated in 2002 and redacting the School of Nursing. When I started my career as an ER nurse, one requirement was TB mask fitting, where they fit a duckbill mask to your face and put a plastic cylinder over a vent opening over your head and then spray in a concentrated sucrose mist. If you can taste even just a bit of sweetness through the mask, you're at risk for contracting TB. So," she asked, "just what the hell are cloth or surgical masks going to do except make ourselves sick? That's it. Any honest doctor, nurse, scientist, or virologist knows that this mask thing is, well, let me clean it up just a bit here, BS. A second opinion? Yep. In order for a mask to work at all, it has to be fit tested," says this time a super high-level surgical nurse at a major metropolitan hospital. And she describes basically the same procedure as the first RN, saying the bottom line is, if your mask isn't fit tested, then there's no guarantee that viral particles are actually being filtered out, or not coming out of you, too. So this mask wearing that everyone's being required to do is, wait for it, yeah, she says the same thing, BS. "And I laugh," she says, "when I see the general public even wearing N95s that they bought down at the local store," well, back when they could get them, "because unless you fit test it, you have no idea whether or not it's even actually working. Bottom line, it's all a mind game." And says Anne Barnhart, "remember, folks, this only applies to N95 level or more masks. Putting a few ridiculous layers of gauze or even more ridiculously fashion fabric, I've even seen denim on them, is absolutely stupid. Because remember, carbon dioxide inhalation is a common method of stunning hogs at slaughter. And all of this has absolutely no purpose whatsoever except to signal your total submission to the great big whopping lie and the totalitarian regime. She notes what your host has been saying for a long time. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. We have an immune system that if we just let it work and quit doing stupid things to it, would be far better at protecting us than any bogus mask BS. She notes that there are a lot of ways to look at a mask, everything from the Masonic burqa to the communist veil of submission to the New World Order hijab. And as John Rao said, the face mask is the modern new Yellow Star of David patch. I thought for a while, folks, that if I ever was going to wear one of those asinine things out in public, I'd want it to say something useful right across the mouth, like, insert Kool-Aid here, or just simply wear a Guy Fawkes mask, like in V for Vendetta. At least those would serve some productive point. Furthermore, says Anne, let me put one more thing out there. How many children are now being deeply terrified of other human beings because of this highly public BS that they're being subjected to, where the mask is a visible, frightening vector of the new terror? How many children right now, she asks as we speak, are telling themselves internally, probably in simple childish terms that they themselves couldn't even yet articulate, but still feel with tremendous force, that other people are somehow bad because they have to wear a mask, and that means to love another human being is something bad that they must never, ever do. She says, yep, what we're seeing here is exactly the making of a diabolical narcissist. Human beings that freely end up choosing to purge love from their soul because of what they've been exposed to during these formative years. This mask crap, writes Anne Barnhart, and I couldn't agree more, folks, is the largest, fastest, diabolical narcissist formation operation ever executed. And in fact, not only is it a total war on the entire world economy and rule of law and individual liberty, but it's also a total war on children especially, although any number of gullible adults are also being snared in the net. Evidently, drag queen story hours weren't quite getting things done fast enough. So now, they're going full Lucifer on us. If we're honest, folks, we have to recognize that we are now in the middle of a revolution, and we're seeing the greatest attack on America, bar none. Time to withdraw consent, take off the mask, and scream, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And we'll pick it up right there when we get back. Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Call. I'm going to start this one off with a question. And there's a number of forms that question could take, but how about this one? What will it take for Americans to finally wake up and realize that their country literally has been stolen while they slept? The good news is that just maybe Americans may actually wake up before the famine or the war. So we'll start this half of the show off with a story that just kind of encapsulates, combines literally everything that's going on in a single bit of, come on, you've got to be kidding me, realism. And most of it, ironically, has to do with a piece written by well-known professor of constitutional law, George Washington University, and honest liberal, if you can imagine that, Jonathan Turley, who called out hypocrites like Speaker for the Traitors Nancy Pelosi and Michigan tyrant Governor Gretchen Whitmer for their response to the highly credible and increasingly numerous allegations of sexual assault and abuse by the former vice president and now presumptive socialist nominee for president, the unindicted criminal and senile but still sexual predator, creepy quid pro Joe Biden. Women's rights attorney, I'd have to put the word sick in there, Lisa Bloom caused a stir this week, wrote Professor Turley, with a position that is at least honest, even if chilling. Bloom stated that she believes that Biden did rape a female staffer, Tara Reid, but she's still going to endorse Joe Biden for president of the United States anyway, she tweeted. I believe you, Tara. Sorry. And this seems to bother Professor Turley. I guess the hypocrisy and all. Bloom believes Reid, who says Biden raped her, but she still wants him to be president anyway. Which leads your host to my point. Come on, folks. It's just the William Jefferson Clinton standard. Rape is just fine. That is, if we do it to you. And there you go, folks. Welcome to America with a K today. So on then to the economic aspect of the rape. Starting with something we've been talking about for a while now. More and more real economists are waking up to the fact that the so-called V-shaped recovery is nothing but a line of COVID BS. And Michael Snyder at the end of the American Dream points out today that a shocking new survey from the Society for Human Resource Management found that 52% of all American small businesses expect to be out of business within 6 months. Now, there is a caveat here. The survey of 375 firms was conducted between the 15th and 21st of April and doesn't account for the fact that Big Brother has decided to let a few of them, just maybe, if they're good little slaves, reopen. Well, a little bit anyway, sometime this month. And as the CEO for the company that took the survey points out, they've tracked COVID-1984's impact on workers and the workplace for months, but these might be the most alarming findings to date. Small business truly is the backbone, or was anyway, of our economy. So when we find out that half or more are worried about being wiped out, let's remember, we're talking roughly about 14 million businesses. And when you add into that the coming food panics and the fact that what Zero Hedge describes as a biblical wave of bankruptcies is about to flood the United States, it shouldn't be hard to realize that the downward economic spiral is already well past the point of no return. From there, a couple of inside baseball economic stories that at least hopefully will help answer the question of how bad is it really. The first one has to do with those long-anticipated negative U.S. interest rates. Now, real interest rates have been negative for quite a while. Real interest rates being what bonds actually yield after you account for real inflation. But says a late Thursday morning headline from Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden, it begins. For the first time ever, futures price is fatal because negative U.S. interest rates are expected to begin starting December of 2020. There are lots of charts and graphs in this one, but the update says this. Now that the seal's finally been broken, the euro-dollar market is beginning to panic, sending Fed fund futures soaring to contract highs, with the first priced-in negative rate now shifting from January 2021 to December 2020 in what appears to be the next market test of the almighty Fed, with stocks, bonds, and now foreign exchange starting to actively price in negative rates as soon as 6 months from today. And the conclusion of this, they say deep down in the piece, is somewhat scary. Despite everything the Fed has done, which includes trillions in explicit liquidity injections and implicit funding backstops, not only does the Fed need to do more, but it would in fact have to cut rates to negative to offset pent-up market imbalances. Can hyperinflation be far behind? There's a fairly technical story from Ronan Manley at BullionStar.com that says the LBMA, or London Bullion Market Gold Price Benchmark, ignores market conditions, and that's a violation of their own charter, but who cares, in the process shortchanging investors. And he notes that the gaping spread between the London spot gold prices and front month COMEX, or CRIMEX, crooked casino gold futures prices now persists for a sixth straight week, triggered by a bullion bank EFP liquidity blow-up back in late March of 2020. And one unappreciated aspect of this gold price discovery scandal is that the daily London LBMA gold price auctions are deliberately ignoring the fake COMEX gold prices when they set the opening price, the starting price, in the twice-daily gold price auction. So basically what he's saying here is that they're building lies upon lies. And, of course, many of us have pointed out for quite a long time that you can't actually buy real gold or silver for the quoted paper prices anyway. Interestingly, though, today, if you're curious, even in the manipulated crooked casinos, gold is up over $36 as I do this recording. That's a 2+% gain to well above $1,700 for a fiat ounce again, while silver is up even more percentage-wise, 3.75% or 55 fiat pennies. That's almost $1,550 for a vapor ounce, but still about 5 whopping bucks less than you'd probably have to pay to get the real stuff in your actual hand. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul remains one of the few actually willing to tell Americans what the problem is and what needs to be done about it. Appearing on Fox News Wednesday, he reminded Americans the economy has to be reopened or else, noting that we have no money. Quote, we have no rainy day account. We have no savings account. The $3 trillion that we've already passed out is imaginary money, said the senator, accurately, referring to the already staggering national debt and a failure to honor the Constitution. It's basically being borrowed, he said, from China. So the irony is we got the virus from China, and now we're going to be more dependent by borrowing more money from China. And he urged that Americans need to be released from, quote, forcible home arrest if there's any chance of any recovery whatsoever. And he slammed the far-left socialist states for wanting to keep the economy shut down. Speaking of which, socialist media giant YouTube has done it again, deleting yet another bit of truth speaking that's not allowed to be heard by the American public. This time it's an interview from the new documentary called Plandemic, featuring former chronic fatigue researcher Judy Milkovitz, who spoke the unspeakable, that America's own Dr. Strangelove, a.k.a. Fauci, is spewing, quote, absolute propaganda, which is true, about COVID-19, and the video censor is literally playing whack-a-mole with new versions of the interview, deleting them just as quickly as they pop up and get another million views or so. This next story is one that I've seen repeated one way or another, day after day now, and it struck me that it would never have happened if we still had a free nation. If we still believed in the founding principles, if we still had any sense of integrity, for crying out loud, or understood what a constitution was. Here's the latest example of what I'm referring to from any number of sources, but this headline comes from Ethan Huff at Natural News about how Knoxville, Tennessee has tried to impose what he called Antichrist restrictions on churches as part of the reopening phases. Yes, Big Brother is going to deign to let the slaves actually do what the Constitution says they had no right to stop in the first place. But still, there's not going to be any more singing, communion, or Bibles allowed in totalitarian Knoxville. So let's start with the good news for those dumbed-down sycophants there in Knoxville who haven't yet risen up in armed rebellion against tyranny. They're now allowed to go back to church as of May 1st. May Day, isn't that interesting? The communist celebration. But the city and county don't want them to sing or take communion or use Bibles. And it's what they call their community strategy for phased reopening. Yes, Big Brother will let you, not all at once, mind you, but a little at a time, start to regain a little bit of what we've stolen away during the communist revolution. Knox County and the city of Knoxville in eastern Tennessee had attempted to impose a lengthy list of restrictions on churches and congregations under the guise of protecting against the Wuhan coronavirus. Now notice, folks, doesn't matter whether the protections actually amount to a hill of beans or not. So even calling them protections is another lie. Placebos is a lot more appropriate. Even pretensions is a better word. But these restrictions have since been overturned at the state level. Now, this is where you have to see heads I win, tails you lose at play. Only what's called core worship, as of course defined by the gods of Knoxville, were allowed as part of the reopening, which forbade anything they decreed in their godlike and unassailable wisdom to be non-essential worship activities. And obviously what that really means is any worship of any other god than them is verboten. Anyway, they're not allowed to join together in groups, classes, youth services, baptism, communion, or Bible reading. Hey, I know. How about if they just promise to only read Romans 13 from the government-inspired version? Now, here's the bad news masquerading as good news. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee issued his own guidance. See, this is one God versus another for the reopening of churches throughout the state, which he said, ready, overrides the attempted Knoxville guidance. And here you thought the Constitution still mattered. No, it's which Big Brother is going to rule. As a result, though, Knoxville churches now, they say, have the option to not follow the guidelines if they so choose. You know what, folks? Back when we once understood that there were certain self-evident truths and that there was a creator who gave us God-given rights and that no government on earth had any authority to revoke those or to claim that the God of the Bible who gave us life didn't give us that free choice these fake gods are now trying to deny. Well, the point is, churches, the kind that worship the real God anyway, as opposed to the 501c3 whore churches that basically have signed up for a different creator, and if they doubt that, have them just read their certificate of incorporation. Well, they have always had the option to, as Scripture puts it, choose life from the one true God himself. But the story says, Executive Order 30, signed by Governor Lee, states that local governments cannot issue their own rules about places of worship because Governor Lee himself has already said he was planning on issuing his statewide guidelines. Can you spot the incredible tyrannical fallacy at work here? The right answer, folks, from a real church that serves the one true living God is, I don't give a blankety blank what you say. You all put your hands on a Bible and swore before God you wouldn't do exactly what you're doing now. And it's about time the American people stood up and pointed that out to these lying, oath-breaking Satanists. The founders put it this way when they outlined their grievances against an evil tyrant named King George III who wouldn't have dared to do even a fraction of what Big Brother in America with a K is now getting away with. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. We don't have just one such tyrant today, folks. We've got at least 50-some, and arguably hundreds if not thousands, of evil minions who walk in men's shoes that are all doing far worse. So what did the signers do? They appealed in their conclusion to the supreme judge of the world. By the way, he doesn't wear a black robe. Too bad so many Casper Milktoast churches in formerly free America seem to have forgotten that, if they ever even knew it. It is, however, encouraging to see a few people who at least at one point seem to have turned their backs on the oath they took before God to preserve and protect and defend the Constitution, maybe starting to realize the error of their ways and turn around. One of those is former federal judge Andrew P. Napolitano, now sometimes with Fox, who asked this week, do we still have a constitution? Well, if you've been paying attention, the obvious answer is no, but at least it's good to see him asking the question. He says he's been taking heat from friends and colleagues for his actual attempts to read that document in what he called steadfast defense of personal liberties and arguments that the Constitution, interpreted in accordance with the plain meaning of its actual words and informed by history, good grief, is there any other honest way to read it? As one famous former Supreme Court justice put it, if so, what's the point of even trying to write it down? Does not permit the government to infringe upon personal freedoms, no matter what they call the level of emergency or even pandemic. For those who agree with me, he says, worry not, we'll persevere. Well, hopefully that part is correct. We'll continue to pray on that score. The rest, though, certainly is. For those who trust in the government, though, big brother, worry a lot, because you're not in good hands. The purpose of the Constitution was to establish a central government and strictly limit it. Some of those limitations are written in the Constitution itself. Most of them that pertain to personal freedom are found in the Bill of Rights, a.k.a. the First Ten Amendments. And by the way, he doesn't say it, I will. They take the form of explicit, unequivocal, thou shalt nots to the federal government. Words that no longer seem to mean anything, like Congress shall make no law, shall not be infringed, no warrant shall issue, and similar absolute imperative prohibitions against exactly what they're now doing. These amendments, he observes correctly, were ratified to restrain the central government from infringing upon personal liberties. And he goes on to say that even the courts have characterized these protected liberties as fundamental. So, continues the former federal judge, the rights to thought, speech, press, assembly, worship, self-defense, privacy, travel, property ownership, interstate commercial activities, and fair treatment from government are plainly articulated, or at least rationally inferred, in those first eight amendments. The ninth is a catch-all, which declares that the enumeration of rights in the first eight doesn't mean that there are no other rights that aren't also fundamental, and that the government is not to disparage or diminish those other rights, while the Tenth Amendment reflects that the states and the people, respectively, have reserved powers to themselves. And he makes a good point with regard to the Ninth Amendment, noting it was especially important to James Madison, its author, because of his view that natural rights, a.k.a. God-given rights or fundamental rights, are integral to each person, that they're too numerous to list as well. And he quotes anti-slavery crusader Lysander Spooner, who put it thusly, a man's natural rights are his own against the whole world, and any infringement of them is equally a crime, whether committed by one man or by millions, whether committed by one man calling himself a robber or by millions calling themselves a government. Unquote. Or even nowadays, I guess, a city government calling itself a little demigod. Natural rights collectively constitute the moral ability and sovereign authority, oh, he said that word, of every human being to make their own personal choices, free from government interference or government permission. They have all the permission they need, folks, spelled out right in Scripture. Read Deuteronomy chapter 30, among others, if you have any doubts on that score. And the only exception to this, of course, as Thomas Jefferson repeatedly pointed out, boils down to, I have a right to nothing, which another has the right to take away. In other words, you don't have the right to make another person's choices for them. And from this it follows, he says, that if governments interfere with our own personal choices, and if we've not consented to their power to interfere, that interference is invalid, unlawful, and because those personal choices are explicitly protected from Big Brother's interference by the Bill of Rights, they're also unconstitutional. From here, he goes on to describe the current tyrannical interferences with the exercise of rights once protected by the Bill of Rights, and notes that they're primarily, so far at least, associated with prohibitions concerning travel, assembly, interstate commercial activities, and the exercise of freedom of religion. And let's not forget, your host interjects here, they really hate the Second and Fourth Amendments, too. But that's been ongoing since even before the COVID-1984 Bolshevik Revolution. But he says these infringements have all come from state governors who claim the power to do so. And they raise at least three profound constitutional issues. Number one, do governors have that inherent power in an emergency to craft regulations that they say carry the force of law? The obvious answer is no. Because, among other things, the guarantee clause of the Constitution mandates a lowercase l republican form of government in all of the states, meaning the separation of powers into three branches, executive, legislative, and judicial, each with a distinct function that cannot be performed constitutionally by either of the other two. And since only a representative legislature can write actual laws that carry criminal penalties and incur the use of force, the governor of a state has no power to do so. In fact, the governor of the state has no constitutional power to actually claim to write laws at all. The second constitutional issue is, can state legislatures delegate away to governors their lawmaking powers? Or for that matter, can the states do it, like they tried to with FDR, to the central government? And again, the answer is no, because the separation of powers prevents one branch of government from ceding to another branch its core constitutionally mandated powers. That separation was crafted not just to preserve the integrity of each branch, but also to assure the preservation of personal liberty by preventing the accumulation of too much power in any one branch. And here I like to quote James Madison, who, referring to Isaiah chapter 33, talking about God alone as our king, our judge, and our lawgiver, and thus his observation that in the hands of God alone do we trust all three of those powers to be combined into one entity. Anything else is literally the very definition of tyranny. And hey, folks, that's what we've got today. And the third big constitutional issue, he says, is, can a state legislature enact laws that interfere with personal liberties once and at least hopefully still protected by the Bill of Rights? Can they prescribe punishments for violation of those so-called laws and authorize governors to use force to compel compliance with them? Again, the answer is no, because all government in America is subordinate to the natural rights articulated in the Bill of Rights and embraced in the Ninth Amendment. Now here, folks, your host likes to quote Amger, Section 177. And it's ever so important we keep doing that. 16 Amger, Second Edition, Section 177 says, quote, "The general misconception is that any statute passed by legislatures bearing the appearance of law constitutes the law of the land." Well, wait a minute. We're not even talking about statutes. We're just talking about bogus decrees by governors or even cities. "The U.S. Constitution," continues the quote, "is the supreme law of the land, and any statute to be valid must be in agreement. It is impossible for both the Constitution and a law violating it to be valid. One must prevail." And this, it continues, is succinctly stated as follows. "The general rule is that an unconstitutional statute, though having the form and the name of law, is in reality no law, but is wholly void and ineffective for any purpose. And that includes forcing you to wear a mask, not shake hands or assemble with your co-worshippers, destroy your business, or sacrifice your children on some altar, since its unconstitutionality dates from the time of its enactment, and not merely from the date of some decision so branding it. As unconstitutional law in legal contemplation, it's as inoperative as if it had never been passed. Such a statute leaves the question that it purports to settle just as it would be had the statute not been enacted. And since an unconstitutional law is void, the general principles follow." And listen to this list carefully, folks, and ask yourself just how many violations, if you can count them, you've seen as the Bolshevik COVID-1984 revolution continues. "It imposes no duties, confers no right, creates no office, bestows no power or authority on anyone, affords no protection, and justifies no acts performed under it. No one is bound to obey an unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce it," unquote. And furthermore, folks, any so-called law enforcement officer that is so ignorant of his oath before God that he tries to enforce it is, in fact, no officer at all. The legal contemplation is that he is acting outside the law, under color of law, impersonating an officer, if you will, and, in fact, therefore, committing a crime. Judge Andrew P. Napolitano summarizes all of that this way. "We should rejoice that there is resistance to gubernatorial ignorance and arrogance that disregards the Bill of Rights. We need resistance to tyranny in order to stay free. And as John Knox, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, and many others have put it since, resistance to tyranny is obedience to God. Power unrestrained, says Napolitano, continues to grow and to corrupt, and history teaches that most people prefer the illusion of safety to the cacophony of liberty. And the only reason we have any of our God-given rights left today is because generations of determined minorities, starting with the revolutionaries in the 1770s, have fought and been willing to die for them. Today, we're governed by dangerous men and women, he says, for they've taken away our ability to make personal choices, and they've used force to try to compel compliance. And in doing so, they've not only violated their oaths before God to uphold the Bill of Rights, they've also committed the criminal acts of nullifying those rights. And by using the powers of state, and yes, in some cases, the federal government to do this, they've made themselves candidates for the federal criminal prosecutions that they so richly deserve if and when saner days ever return. Which takes us to where I'm headed today. If Americans don't realize that what they've almost already lost is worth fighting for, not only will those days never return, but they will have lost absolutely everything.